A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging these arts organizations. We'll look at the impact of the economy, technology, and society on the arts, the importance of arts education, and how these organizations and ensembles are adjusting and innovating as they face the future. Today, we'll get some insight into the connections between music and the brain and the way human development has impacted and been impacted by music. My guest will be neurologist and flutist Carl Ellenberger, whose new book, Theme and Variations, explores some of the connections between music, health, and brain development. No news this week, as we'll just go straight into our feature. It seems almost weekly there are new studies linking the way music and musical training can benefit how children learn, improve the life quality of those dealing with serious or chronic illnesses, or simply make our lives happier and more fulfilling. This type of research has been supported by advances in technology and increased interest in academia and the medical profession in exploring these connections. In his new book, Theme and Variations, Musical Notes by a Neurologist, published by Synacumen Press, Carl Ellenberger explores some of these findings and examines the way that music may have benefited from, and in turn affected, human development over the millennia. While Ellenberger chose medicine as his career, he's also a flutist who studied at the Eastman School of Music and kept music as an important part of his life, including his involvement at Gretna Music in Mount Gretna, Pennsylvania. I spoke with him recently about his experiences and what inspired him to write a book that explores the interconnections between his own two passions.
Well, I've lived my whole life as a neurologist and as a musician, specifically a flutist and person who is called in the industry a presenter, that is, making music happen so people can come and hear it. It just naturally followed from that. I read long ago some words by Lewis Thomas, who was an eminent physician. He was an oncologist, and he was eventually the chancellor of Sloan Kettering Institute in New York. And in one of his many books, he used to write for the New England Journal, as well as the Saturday Review and the New Yorker. And in one of his chapters, I saw this a few years ago, rereading it, he said, "If you are looking about for really profound mysteries, essential aspects of our existence for which neither the sciences nor the humanities can provide any sort of explanation, I suggest you start with music." And it occurred to me, well, there's a bunch of things that I know about, and a lot of things have changed since 1980 when he wrote that. There's been a surge in interest in the scientific community towards the understanding of what music is and why we want to play it and listen to it. And I thought that would be a very interesting topic to start learning about. And the way that I learn things is by reading them, but also by trying to write them so that other people could understand them. I started that kind of study when I became a young medical faculty member, and I very quickly learned that I'm going to have to give a whole bunch of lectures to the medical students, and that was the best. I've just stumbled on a good way to learn. You have to be able to write about something and talk about it. That's the best way to learn about it.
Well, what are some of the most important or perhaps most fascinating discoveries or theories that have grown up and have been found over the last several decades linking music to the way the brain works?
Well, the first observation was brought about by the functional MRI scanner. If you put a musician or anyone who knows about music in a functional MRI scanner, that's different than a diagnostic MRI scan that you would get to see your stroke or your brain tumor. Functional scanner shows where the action is happening in the brain. And if you put someone in say, put a pianist in the MRI scanner and ask him to, in his mind, play a Chopin etude, or if you put a person who is very used to listening to music and say, think about your favorite piece of music, start it out or sing it in your mind, you look at the functional MRI scanner and you see that it lights up in the old trite way like a Christmas tree, all sorts of locations in the brain from top to bottom light up. And there's very rare other thoughts that you can, or media or topics that will do that like music does. And so that gave rise to the idea that music requires the entire brain. It activates and exercises the entire brain all over. And starting from that, you can plan specific experiments to try to figure out, or you can start thinking of the brain rather as a network, like a computer, rather than we used to think about as a place that is composed of lots of locations. There's a location for vision, there's a location for hearing, there's a location for memory. A much better way to think of the brain is that it is multiple networks. And there are something like 86 billion brain cells, neurons, and there, I can't remember the exact number, there's something like 800 trillion connections between those nerve cells, so it is very much like a computer. And music is a good way to start learning about all those connections. I'll have people listening to music and parse the different kinds of things that we think about in music, such as harmony and rhythm and melody, and you can start working out how those all of those traits are processed by the brain.
Well, there's quite a lot of interesting discussion in the book about the evolution of the brain and how that supported the role of music in our culture. How has the brain developed to support music making and enjoyment?
Well, if you start out with the lowest forms of the brain, which are now in the human brain, located way in the middle, deep down at the bottom of the brain, those are the parts of the brain that regulate simple things, simple drives like the appetite or drive for reproduction, or simple things like walking and things that all animals do. But during the course of evolution towards the Homo sapiens, the brain has developed what we call the neocortex, which is the large part of the brain on the top that has grown up and forward and backwards as evolution has progressed to the human. And it's the neocortex, for example, is where language is processed, the networks that process language. And so you can say that just like lower animals like dogs and cats don't speak, they also don't hear or understand or remember music, a very important requirement of the brain for playing and appreciating music is musical memory. If you don't, if you hear something and you don't remember it after it stops, which is the case with higher monkeys, they don't have any memory of it. They may be played a symphony or any kind of music, and once it stops, they have no recollection of it whatsoever. So the neocortex is the key to understanding how the brain processes music.
Now, you devote several chapters to the way music and wellness have been linked in some of the discoveries and thoughts about where that could lead us, whether it's in overall healing, or more specifically with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. What has recent research suggested about this connection, and are there any caveats we need to be mindful of when trying to interpret the data?
Well, the caveat, first of all, is that millions of claims have been made for the healing power of music. You can read about that all over the the place, and there are lots of what we call anecdotal reports about how music really saved my Uncle Joe when he started to get Alzheimer's disease. And the power of music to heal is very specific, and we have to learn more about exactly which situations, which diseases, which symptoms, and what kind of music and how do you use music make it valuable. And so far, we're at the very beginning of understanding the healing power of music. One little progress that we have made in this going in the specific direction is that if you learn something, particularly language or skill, including music when you're very young, like the ages of the first decade of your life, which is what we call a critical period when your brain is most plastic, has the most neuroplasticity. When you're that age, you can learn things very easily and very quickly. And those are the first things, that networks that are laid down in your brain, and they are the last to go. So if you are starting to lose your memory with Alzheimer's disease, you can't remember what you had for lunch, or you can't remember that you met this person yesterday and he seems like a totally new stranger today, you can still go deep down into your brain and remember those things that you learned in childhood. And if music was one of them, that comes out very easily. Somebody starts playing the Star Spangled Banner and you can start singing it, or any of the childhood nursery tunes or simple Mary Had a Little Lamb things that may be in an advanced stage of Alzheimer's disease, the only way that you can express yourself. And that's sometimes very valuable for Alzheimer's patients who can't make their needs known or can't say it in words. Another very specific use of music is for Parkinson's. Music exists in time, and Parkinson's is partly a disease of movement which occurs in time. And so a Parkinson patient who has trouble walking might be found to walk much better and almost normally if something like the Sousa March is played at 120 beats per minute. And the patient who normally can take only small steps or sometimes is frozen in place, when he hears a piece of music like that, particularly if he's heard it in his childhood, he may just step out forward and start to walk in a normal fashion. Those are two of the very, very specific ways that music can be used in a healing sense. And there are other more obvious ways that music can be healing. If you're feeling down and low, some people like to hear very sprightly, happy music that can bring up their emotions. I'd like to hear, when I'm feeling sad and blue, I like to hear some really sad, slow movement of a Mahler symphony or something like that to sort of feed my sorrow. Makes me feel better and relaxed.
Now, in the book, you also address some of the challenges facing the classical music world, and it's particularly its future. What would you say is the matter with classical music today, as you title one of your chapters, and how do we move that forward?
Well, the conundrum in the classical music world is that whereas there's been a surge of young people all over the world who want to learn and play classical music. For example, there are at least 2 million Chinese children who are learning to play the piano. And many of them, I guess, I'm only guessing, see that as a route, if they get really good, to a career and coming in off the farms that their ancestors have lived on for millennia. And all over Asia, there are children who are learning classical music. In fact, all over the world, and there are more good musicians now as a result in the world today by many fold than there were when I was a student you look at a conservatory like Juilliard, half of the students or more are Asian. If you look at an orchestra, there's far more diversity in the membership. But at the same time, the audiences for classical music have been slowly diminishing. That's been an observation for centuries. People in Bach's and Mozart's time said the same thing, that classical music audience is about to eventually die out because it isn't the music that is favored by young people. And so the solutions to that, and the good news is that there are countless ways that those of us who are advocates and enjoy not just classical music, but all good music that takes some time to learn and to master the performance of, any music can be good music, whether it comes from an Indian sitar or any ancient instrument from Asia. If people learn to communicate through any kind of music, I don't like to talk about classical music because people think of old whiskered men and black evening dress and formality and difficulty learning and understanding it. Classical is an unfortunate term, so I generally talk about any kind of good music, jazz, country music, folk music, particularly international music of any kind that is seriously learned and listened to. All of that is unfortunately in trouble because we have not done whatever is necessary to keep audiences' attention and understanding. And that's because it takes a little bit of effort. Any good music takes a little bit of effort. Best put in when you're young and your brain is nimble and plastic. And one of the problems is that music and art in schools are the first things to go when the budget needs to be cut. So there are many, many ways of trying to restore that interest, but I think it all needs to be started by priming the pump early on in childhood, which is the root of the problem, and that is something that has not fully been addressed and has not succeeded in solving the problem, except in isolated parts of the country. Out here on the West Coast and Los Angeles and San Francisco, that's not so much of a problem as it is in our other parts of the country, because there are lots of programs for children and other kinds of early experiences provided for children in music. And that was actually one of my motivations for writing the book, is to advocate for good music staying in the minds of people.
Well, now you've pursued both music and medicine and science as you move throughout your career. What drew you to each field, and how did you decide, or what fueled your decision to not necessarily choose one over the other?
Oh, it was all a very mundane answer to that. There's nothing that marks me as very a creative or inspired person. I started music lessons at the age of 3, piano lessons, and I wasn't very good, and my teacher wasn't very good, and I didn't practice much. But then in the 5th grade, all the students were invited. That's all around the country, all around the world. That happens at about the 5th grade. The band director comes in one day to the classroom and says, we're going to start the band practice. Bring in an instrument that you have, or we've got lots of instruments for you to try. And I happened to have my father, who was a doctor, that's the other half of my career, was given a guitar for a birthday, and he was an ophthalmologist, and he didn't want to get calluses on his fingers, so he traded in the guitar for a flute, which he never played. He put it away in the cabinet, and I said, oh, there's a flute in the cabinet. I can save my parents money by carrying it off to school and starting to play it. Well, it turned out that I was, having had the initial learning of music on the piano, at least I couldn't play the piano, but I could read music. And I knew the basics of the the clefs and the quarter notes versus half notes and rhythms and measures and things like that. So I had a leg up when it came to starting to play the flute, and the fingering on the flute's pretty easy. I took to it very well, and I enjoyed playing in the band. You got out of classes once a day or study hall, and it was fun to play in the band, and the bands got better. And throughout high school, I continued to enjoy doing that. But I had always intended to be a doctor, just like my father, because I admired my father. He was one of the best guys in my life. And so I went off to college. At the last minute, I decided to go to the University of Rochester because they had the Eastman School of Music, and started there, expecting to just sign up for flute lessons at the Eastman School. And so I went down my first week at the University of Rochester, walked in and went up to the receptionist at the Eastman School, and I said, I want to take flute lessons here. And they kind of laughed. I didn't have any idea that the entire flute class of one of the best flute teachers in the country, that's why I went there, had auditioned during the year before and highly selected to attend the school and to study flute with Joseph Mariano. But they said, oh, all right, you can play for somebody. We'll see whether you're any good. So I played an audition on the spot, and I got accepted into the class of Joseph Mariano. And he very graciously gave me flute lessons every Saturday afternoon for 4 years. And at the end of that time, I went off to medical school and said, well, that's the end of my flute career. But the telephone started ringing, and a lot of the people I knew at the Interlochen Center for the Arts when I was there in high school turned out to be at Yale Music School, and they knew I was coming, so they informed all the agents and managers and the Yale School of Music that I was there. So I said, oh, all right, I might as well play the flute for fun while I go through medical school. Yep, the Yale Medical School had what was called then the Yale system, which provided plenty of free time for independent study and research. And I figured that's a pretty good way to do some independent study and research by playing in the Yale Orchestra and the New Haven Symphony. And actually, every little town in New England in those days had a symphony orchestra, so I signed up for a lot of them and played the flute as much through medical school as I studied medicine, which I was a little guilty then because other students were doing research and I was just playing music. But now I'm very happy that I did that, because it's become half of my life. Medicine was the other half. I happened to enter a medical specialty, neurology, which has the highest rate of burnout in any of the medical specialties. And I was able to hang on long enough throughout a career in neurology by playing music so that I burned out very late in life. And now I can enjoy medicine as an avocation and music as an avocation.
What are some other directions that you think we may come across, you know, as neurobiology and science continues to explore music? What are some other directions and areas that you hope are enlightened in the future?
Well, that's the whole idea that music is a language. The principles of learning a language are that when you're 2 and 3 years old and learning your first language, it comes very easy. And we know that if you live in a bilingual or even trilingual home, children can learn all of the languages. They learn them all at the same time, but somehow they learn how to separate the languages one from another. If grandmother speaks Polish and your own mother speaks English and your uncle Tom speaks Spanish, kids can pick that up pretty well at a young age during the critical period of plasticity. Music is in the same way, and we've learned that bilingual people and people who are literate in at least one language have a much better chance in later life of learning things and going into fulfilling careers. It turns out that at that young age, doing anything with your brain builds hardware. We can even measure that on scans. If you look at kids who have started to play the piano before the age of 5 and compare them to kids starting to play the piano after the age of 7, you find out that the corpus callosum, the connections between the two hemispheres of the brain, is bigger in those kids that start out younger. And the same principles apply to languages and other things that are learned early. And so that music is one way that you can exercise and build brain power when you're 3 and 4 years old. You can always sing and dance and sing with people and memorize and learn to sing songs yourself. You can't learn nuclear physics or philosophy or statistics at that age. But if you learn simple things like language and music, you can build a bigger brain that has more capacity that will serve you much better as you get older. And you can rededicate some of that hardware to learning whatever else you want. I'm convinced that a good musician, I take Yo-Yo Ma, for example, by the age of 13 or 14, he became Yo-Yo Ma of the cello. He could do everything that he needed to do. He had all of the skills and hardware. And then he could turn his attention to other things. That's what he learned when he went to Harvard. And I think I did, to some degree, the same thing. By the time I was 18, I had done a good portion of my 10,000 hours of musical practice that seems to be the Erickson's law of learning music. You have to put down that many hours of music while your brain still can build hardware before the age of 18 or 20. And then you have a brain that is highly functioning and lots of networks that you can turn your attention to other things, other learning. You can learn to be a lawyer or a doctor or a historian or philosopher during your 20s and then continue lifelong learning, which is music is also good for too. If you continue playing music throughout your life, you're resistant, or at least you can prolong Alzheimer's disease for several more years if you keep on exercising your brain, building up cognitive reserve all your life, so that when it starts to decay in your 70s or 80s, you've got a lot more to go on.
That was Carl Ellenberger, a neurologist and flutist, whose new book, Theme and Variations, Musical Notes by a Neurologist, is published by Sun Acumen Press. You can hear additional excerpts from our conversation, including his role at Gretna Music in Pennsylvania, on the Odd Tempo page of our website at wwfm.org. You can read more on his blog at carlellenberger.com/blog. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you each week on Odd Tempo, exploring the challenges and changing dynamics in the arts world. But remember that programs like Odd Tempo are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for your support of the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to Odd Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. Odd Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.